When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Myself, Chakras, episode 139.
There's a suffering which comes from practice, and there's a suffering which comes from not practicing. Choose the suffering that comes from practice.
The seven chakras, swirling vortices of energy, positioned throughout our body, from the base of the spine to the crown of the head. For thousands of years, this ancient wisdom has been passed on from master to disciple. What are the functions of these energy centers? And could these chakras help you unlock your destiny and find your true purpose? Welcome to My Seven Chakras. And now, your host, Aditya Jayakumar.
What's up, Action Tribe? AJ here, founder and host of My Seven Chakras, and you are back to your hub for inspiration, your home for transformation, and your on-demand radio station where we dive deep into the mysteries of the ancient world and provide you tips, advice, and insights into how you can transform your life. This is a show where we encourage you to take massive action and embrace challenges, because in life, your life lesson comes after your test, unlike in school where you were taught a lesson and then tested. Action Takers, we have an amazing episode in store for you today, where we are going to learn more about yoga. But before that, let me ask you this one question. When was the first time you practiced yoga? I repeat, when was the first time you ever practiced yoga? I really want to know. So tweet it out, post it on Facebook or Instagram using the hashtag #MySevenChakras so that I can find and reply to your message. And of course, if you want to email me, my email address is aj@mysevenchakras.com. Really simple, aj@mysevenchakras.com. And with that, we are now ready to bring you our featured guest for today, Gabriel Halpern. So Gabriel, are you ready to inspire?
I'm ready to inspire. I'm breathing in right now to inspire myself.
Awesome. So Gabriel Halpern holds a BA in philosophy, an MA in health psychology, and was trained at the Iyengar Yoga Institute in San Francisco and Pune, India. Gabriel has practiced since 1970 and gives workshops nationally. He is the founder and director of the Yoga Circle in Chicago, Illinois since 1985. For over 20 years, he was a core performance faculty member at DePaul University's Theater Department. In 2011, he was awarded the Mentor of the Year award by the Mankind Project. Recently, Yoga Circle was voted the best traditional Hatha studio by Chicago Magazine, owing to the direct influence of BKS Iyengar and over 4 decades of continuous study. Gabriel's teaching is all that is yoga: zeal in practice, science, art form, lifestyle, and mystical mentoring. Gabriel Halpern has been studying and practicing breathwork for over 40 years, first with Kundalini master Yogi Bhajan and then with BKS Iyengar and his family. Gabriel brings a wealth of knowledge and experience, sure to light the fire of tapas and get you to hit the mat again and again. Gabriel was also noted as one of the 100 most influential yoga teachers in America by Sunaima.com. So Gabriel, that was a short intro about you. I can't wait to learn more about your story and the advice that you're going to share with us today. But take about a minute and tell us a bit more about yourself.
Well, I like the connection with the theater department because my first yoga class was at Queens College in New York City back in 1968. I was an acting major at the time, And the company that was brought in to teach that particular course was very big into sensory training in the late 60s. That was in vogue in the theater department. So they taught us these exercises about projecting our voice and doing Chinese acrobatics and massage techniques and yoga, but they never told us what they were doing. So I was actually exposed to it before I realized that yoga was a part of the whole training. And then my first exposure to classes in yoga was in 1970. I moved to California to Marin County, just north of San Francisco, and I lived across the street from the College of Marin in Kentfield. And that's where I saw the first Kundalini yoga class going on. And I was really interested because of my desire to get away from the psychedelic drug situation that had been characteristic of my early hippie years. And this was a very powerful technique that I sensed was going to move me into another aspect of my own personal growth and cultivation of spirituality, and that's what it did. So I ended up moving into a Kundalini yoga ashram run by Yogi Bhajan, and the first 6 years of my yoga practice were conditioned by Kundalini yoga, which I do want to talk about later on in terms of the chakras and, as you said, breaking down the esoteric understanding, so it's something that's practical for people. It took me maybe 7 years to understand Kundalini and simplify it by saying the energy of consciousness. As you expand your consciousness, more energy becomes available to you. So that was a revelation to me. And I just kept going. And then in 1976, I moved to Florida. And that's where I met my first Iyengar teacher. And that was the opening of a whole new chapter in my personal practice and also certainly my teaching, the influence of my teaching. And after 11 years of practicing with senior teachers in that technique. In 1987, I went to India on my first time, met Mr. Iyengar, which I was already in love with him, even though I hadn't even met the man.
Mm-hmm.
That began the change that I've stayed with for the last 35 years. Actually, 1976 is when I started practicing Iyengar yoga. So actually, it's been like 40 years in that technique.
Wow. So thanks a lot for that amazing intro. So we're going to start today's show with a dose of inspiration. So help us understand, what is your favorite inspirational quote and how does that quote play out in your day-to-day life?
It's a quote, I would say, from Gita Iyengar, Mr. Iyengar's daughter, which says, "There's a suffering which comes from practice and there's a suffering which comes from not practicing. Choose the suffering that comes from practice." Now, why that has particular relevance for me is when I was 15, back in 1963, I injured my back. And that was certainly one of the motivations over the years to do something to try to help myself. Even though I stupidly played contact sports through high school and college, putting myself at risk. But that was prior to my putting to rest the macho part of my personality. And when I got into yoga, there was a tremendous improvement by flexibility. But it wasn't until I started studying the Iyengar technique that awareness of the alignment details and the use of props helped me so tremendously that I realized this is something I had to pass on. So I've tried to develop much more along the lines of therapeutic yoga to help other people who, like me, are carrying around a lifelong injury, something that maybe cannot be medically, surgically improved, but through lifestyle changes can at least give you a handle on how to deal with some chronic pain. And what I've learned is that if you don't do anything, there's a suffering that comes from not practicing. That's worse.
Mm-hmm.
So even when you try to do something or hit the mat again, you know, it takes a while. This is not something that happens overnight. We never try to pitch yoga as a quick fix or a hocus pocus, some kind of magic that's going to change you. There's manual labor, and the tax on the system is you got to put yourself on the mat. But the benefits that accrue over time not only, of course, change your anatomy and your approach to your anatomy, but your whole choice of lifestyle, which is something, of course, that I hope this interview helps people to move one step closer to, that ultimately your yoga is your lifestyle. It isn't just studying yoga practice per se, or as we say, you don't study Buddhism and Hinduism, you study mind.
Mm-hmm.
So yoga becomes a practice through which you watch the nature of your own consciousness and ultimately trace it to its source. But at a more pedestrian level, the first thing we want to do is deal with the suffering at the level of stress. Everybody has stress. There isn't anybody I know who is born on the material plane who isn't dealing with something, and usually quite a lot on their plate. And I'm not even restricting this to the physical difficulties that people have, either through genetics or accidents, hospitalizations, or personal neglect and abuse of your own body. There are many reasons why people have physical ailments, but yoga talks about the unity of the mind and the body. My teacher used to say, no one knows where the body ends and the mind begins. No one knows where the mind ends and the soul begins. So apparently yoga helps you go deeper and deeper into subtler aspects of your own self, which are there, but for most people, it's like unused capital. If you don't tap into it, you don't even realize that you have this as a magnificent potential. So if you have injuries and you start to make yourself feel better after a while, you don't like that closed down feeling. You like what it felt like when your muscles were more open and your joints were more aligned and your breathing was easier and your mind felt much more calm and clear and concentrated. So that becomes the impetus to say, hey, I got to take this seriously. So I would say that's the first thing I would tell people, that your practice is important on a daily basis, like giving yourself a gift. But at the same time, even if you practice every single day, you're only on the mat a short amount of time. Most people realistically are not going to spend more than a half hour to an hour. The practitioners who spend more time than that, they're in a separate case. They're like Olympians going for the gold. So nothing wrong with that. But the average person who's going to benefit from yoga is going to put in a little time, whether it's 15 to 20 minutes or a half hour to 40 minutes. So be realistic about that. Most people's life is very full. And to add one more thing seems to be overwhelmed, but it's really worth it to do it. And yet, even if you do it daily, the most important gift that you take back from that is, how does this affect the way I am in my daily life, both in the ethics, in my dealing with other people in social and personal relationship contexts? How does it affect my view of what I want to do in life? Am I not interested just in same old, same old? Obviously, yoga gets you involved in a certain kind of quest, a certain kind of search, a certain kind of inward journey to find the depth in yourself that you may have suspected was there, but you didn't know how to tap into it. And yoga helps you tap into it, not only to improve your yoga practice, but to make your daily life filled with aliveness and vitality.
So I love the quote that you shared. It's so profound and powerful. There's a suffering which comes with practice, and then there's a suffering which comes without practice. Choose the suffering that comes with practice. I think this is really, really profound, because it teaches our listeners and me as well that we always have a choice. Because if we don't do anything, that inaction is the worst kind of suffering. You spoke about the importance of consistency and discipline, because those two factors are critical, irrespective of how long you do the practice for. If you do it daily, that helps mold our behavior, mold our outlook, mold the mind, and change our life, and help us embark on this quest of sorts to find our true self. So thanks a lot for sharing. And let me ask you this, what inspired you to start the Yoga Circle Studio?
Actually, it came from reading a Harvard Business Review that made me look at what was the ulterior motive behind, you might call it the mission statement behind any business that starts, separate from the public interface, which is teaching the yoga postures. And it turns out that from my point of view, the purpose of having a yoga studio is to build community, to create an oasis in the city, a safe and non-threatening space where people can come and apprentice themselves to a discipline where there are knowledgeable teachers who can certainly initiate you into the path, get you going, help you to move to a continuing or more advanced practice. And then if you stay with it long enough, good teachers are able to turn you into teachers yourself, if that's where your dharma or your optimum path of unfolding is leading you. So I would just say it's being a community builder and wanting to provide for people the same thing that happened to me. I didn't learn yoga alone. I learned it both in a class situation and an ashram situation. Mm-hmm. And it opened me up into the broader understanding of how do you connect to the community? Because once you have such a fantastic gift of service like yoga, it's natural to want to share it with everybody.
So I love your definition, to build a safe oasis in the midst of the city, where someone who wants to embark on this quest can come find his or her mentor who will guide them, who will assist them and provide them feedback that will help them transform their life. I think this is amazing. Now, earlier you spoke about the mind-body-soul connection. So what is your definition of yoga?
Well, I like to use the classical definition of yoga. It's the intentional stopping of the spontaneous workings of your mind. If you can't find out what else is going on besides your own thinking, then you're going to be shut off from a potential insight. One philosopher, Alan Watts, says, just as you have to stop talking to hear what somebody else has to say, so you have to stop thinking to find out if there's something else in your consciousness besides thought. And that can only be done with stillness and silence. And so if everyone could just snap their fingers and make their mind stop and find the stillness and silence, there'd be more realized yogis around. But obviously, it's not as simple as that. That's the reason why they use the word path, that it's something you have to tread or something you have to walk on or something that, in terms of a process orientation, you have to begin and keep going. You're like making bread, you know, you knead the dough 1,000 times, or conjugating a verb, you repeat it again and again. And anything that has a mechanical part, you have to practice to the point of repletion, like scales on a piano. You can't go too fast, otherwise you fumble over the notes. You have to go slow enough, and then with practice, you pick up speed, and then eventually you're able to do an arpeggio or whatever it is that indicates, okay, I'm moving along. So in the same way, there are stages in yoga that must be done for the beginner in order to arrive at a deeper place. And a good image or metaphor is you never find paragraphs right away. Just, it doesn't happen. You have to have sentences before you have paragraphs. And you can't even have sentences until you have words. Mm-hmm. And you can't have words until you understand the letters and the sounds that are connected to the letters when you see it, when you hear it, and then when you see it written down. So in the same way, there are building blocks in yoga that seem to hierarchically move you from a lower to a higher state. However, I want to make this critique on this because this is one of the paradoxes. And remember, paradox is a truth standing on its head trying to get your attention, even though it may seem to be stating two different things which are mutually exclusive, but nonetheless.
Sure.
The left brain is the part that does understand, well, absolutely, I can't begin day one and immediately have a realization on the next day. Or as Mr. Anger would say, marry today, get and deliver tomorrow, get pregnant today, deliver tomorrow. No, that doesn't happen. There's an interim period, a gestation period, where things have to incubate and work. Okay, our left brain totally understands that. However, almost all teachings, whether they're teachings from yoga or any of the other psychotechnologies or disciplines of consciousness that are out there, also say that the end of the path is a complete sense of being in the present moment, totally here and now, in reality, eyes open, awake, completely full, in terms of your being. Well, that's not in the future. That's never in the future. That's like when the disciples ask Christ, when will the kingdom of God come? And he says, the kingdom is spread before the eyes of the sons and daughters of humankind, but they don't see it. It doesn't come with expectation. So that would indicate that our right brain might understand the teaching in a very, very different way. Because if the right brain believes that the teaching has to be over time, through a process, then that means your whole life is basically on postponement, that you need time between now and then in order to, assuming you do it correctly and sufficiently, to achieve what they say there is to be achieved. But that puts it off into the future. And every mm-hmm. step that you take to embody that teaching is done because you believe you don't have it. And so there's the contradiction. How do you, at one level, live in time and go through appropriate stages that build from, you know, A through Z, and yet at the same time not be caught up in the postponement of something, but instead be full in your day-to-day, moment-to-moment, instant-to-instant reality? That's what I would call the bitch of the teaching.
So firstly, I love your definition, the intentional stopping of the spontaneous working of our mind. I think that's one of the most clear, brief, and complete definitions of yoga I've heard in a while, and I'm going to incorporate that into my learning for sure. And I love that you spoke about that beautiful paradox about the interim period or the gestation period that our left brain understands, and then how our right brain perceives that very same teaching in terms of the here and now. So it seems like we need to dream big and understand that gestation period, understand that the transformation will take time, but take small steps in the here and now so that we are not always waiting for that one day, but we are always moving towards that destination.
Yeah, true.
So diving a bit deeper, what is Iyengar yoga?
Well, there's a Hatha yoga, which is one of the approaches to what's called Kaya Sadhana, using the body as the way to develop awareness of yourself and your ultimate inner nature. And of course, how does that connect you to other people? Because to be means to be related. So always this is going to come back to whatever you're doing yourself, how is it going to affect your own relationships? Carl Jung has a statement that says if you go deep enough into yourself, your own soul turns back into the world. So you really never have to worry about getting too far out and becoming a recluse or a hermit or misunderstanding renunciation in such a way that takes you out of contact with your loved ones in your daily life. That's not really true. So Mr. Iyengar is a person who made a Herculean effort in his life to explore yoga asana and find the connections and the parallels to it to the rest of yoga, whereas many people see yoga as a hierarchical system that begins with ethics, goes to body postures, breath control, relaxation, and then successive stages of meditation till you reach one of the yoga words that implies enlightenment or realization. Samadhi would be one word they use, or moksha, liberation, or kaivalya, isolation of consciousness from its contents. So that sounds so abstruse. He is able to bring it down to the body and show you how, through the use of the asanas, it's not just a handmaiden or a stepping stone to something higher, but the whole understanding of yoga can be embodied in the correct approach to asana. But more important than that was just being in the presence of somebody who's like so on fire, such a living embodiment of what the teaching is trying to get across. It's an unforgettable experience. But the thing is, when you're in the presence of the master, like any true initiation, a lot of fear comes up. You don't know what's about to happen next. You're really out of control. But you're so focused on what's going on that if it's your good fortune, your life karma, to end up in the presence of the master, believe me, you're totally in what we call living absorption. You are nowhere else. You're not in the past. You're not in the future. You're not thinking about your age. You're not thinking about your gender. You're not thinking about your 401k. All you're thinking about is, I am totally focused on whatever the master says. I'm going to do my best to try to embody that. And then you get a transmission. It's called Shaktipat. Something like an electroplating flow, an arcing happens between you and the master. And after all those years of study or reading and realizing or thinking that, gee, I heard that there's a power, right? But you think it's outside of yourself. And then through the grace of the master, you realize it's in me. I'm discovering the potential. It's in me. And that, you know, takes you on a whole other thing where then you, of course, revere your master for the rest of your life, whether they're embodied or not, because they're the one who helped you realize this. But yeah, it just develops a tremendous amount of humility and not arrogance, because you realize this potential is in every human being. We, out of compassion, we want the people who are suffering to awaken to their own potential and then go help other people, which is usually how the path is. Like a lit candle gets it from an unlit candle, gets it from a lit candle.
Wow.
And then go thou and do likewise. So Mr. Iyengar just represents a person to me whose commitment to practice and to the art form is so impeccable that if you're lucky enough to have a model in your life, then you want to say, okay, I want to be as close to that as I can. I'm not going to be a clone of that. I'm going to be my own person, but still I'm going to revere the guidance and the memory of somebody who got me on fire and taught me how to stay on fire. So, you know, what can I, Mr. Iyengar, you know, who's voted one of the 100 most influential people of last century, his personal practice and has influenced thousands of teachers and literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions, and I don't think that's an exaggeration, of people across the planet, because he's not limited certainly to the huge following in the United States, but he's a worldwide figure. There's Iyengar centers all over the world. So that's an indication of his influence in terms of his shakti or his power to transmit what he knows, even though we only got a small amount, even though he's teaching for like 70 or 80, we only got a small amount of the depth of what the man had to share with us. You know, there's an interesting quote from the Buddha who picks up a bunch of leaves in his hand and then says to the monks and nuns, are there more leaves in my hand or more leaves in the forest? And they all say, oh, more leaves in the forest, sir. He says, well, what I know compared to what I'm teaching you is the leaves in the forest compared to the leaves in my hand. Yet still, just the leaves in my hand are enough to get you liberated. So that's what I feel like. You know, maybe I only got crumbs from the master's table, but those crumbs have served me and literally thousands of students over the year. I don't need to have, you know, to know how much wine there is in the tavern to get drunk. So thankfully enough, I got a little taste, and I'm very, very grateful for that. And all of his things, teaching you how to modify poses for people who have limitations, the invention of props to help give access to people who are in a post-operative condition or in an aged or weakened condition that they can't do the poses independently, getting women involved, doing demonstrations in school, so many things that were revolutionary and unique to his bringing yoga to both India and the West. And, you know, other than that, he's just an inspiration in terms of, is he solid? Do I have to worry about when he was alive, will he be practicing tomorrow? Or is he too lazy? Like, you know, give yourself a day off. No. Totally on fire. And when you know there's one human being, one adult in the world, one mature personality in the world who you can project that kind of faith on, that does wonders for inspiring yourself to be an embodiment of your own understanding of spirit. And then whoever you come in contact with, something is going to rub off. You know, the mind at peace finds its way of affecting its environment.
So on the same topic, you learned and practiced yoga at the foot of the master BKS Iyengar in Pune, India. Going back in time, what was the entire experience like living in India, a new culture, living with the master, learning new skills?
Loved it. First of all, the people who had been there before had left, you know, intro to Pune, you know, intro to the institute.
Oh, okay.
You know, so you had a little sense of like, you know, how to be smart in terms of what to eat and, you know, where to live the first time that you're there. So I was very, very fortunate that, you know, I took precautions and didn't get sick in terms of eating food that sometimes if you're not used to the kind of dal and you know, some of the maybe bacteria even in the water till your body gets accustomed to it. If you start off with some kind of stomach ailment, believe me, it's not a good thing to be there when all your hopes were like, I'm coming here, you know, in a great state of health and I'm going to get even healthier. So that was very, very helpful to have some prior information from the people who'd gone before. India is a fantastic place, especially for yogis, because it is still in America, even though there's maybe 18 million people, they say, according to Yoga Journal, probably much more, doing yoga. The respect that you get for doing yoga in the United States is kind of not the same as people in India. Even if they're not practicing yoga, they recognize that you're here honoring our ancient culture. I felt so welcomed and so warm. Indian people, to me, were extremely chatty, very, very politically aware. And being from New York City originally myself, I'm already used to having a diversity of cultures, mm-hmm. and having everybody have an opinion, from, you know, the taxi cab driver to, like, you know, the head magistrate. Everybody has an opinion. So a very, very interesting place both to speak to people, get to know people. The culture in Pune was fantastic, to go to different concerts and be involved in not just soccer, but cricket, you know, to learn about cricket, things like that. Being exposed to Indian culture that way was fantastic. You know, we also took upon ourselves to visit various museums and temples. So that whole cultural experience, in addition to the yoga, was just an injection of learning about it firsthand instead of reading about it. And so that was fantastic. And then now you get to the Institute. You know, it's such an international cavalcade of stars. You know, there are people like yourself, like-minded, from all over the world. And that in itself is just a fantastic bunch of friends to make for life and learn from them in their practice. And then, you know, you take your assigned classes the first time you're there. And I was still fortunate to be there when they were still doing teacher trainings for the international teachers. And so although the trainings were taught by Gita and Prashant, the son, Mr. Iyengar comes into every class and interrupts. There's no way that he can watch what's going down without something in him getting incensed about it. It's not being transmitted the right way. Of course, to be in the presence of a person who can take over in an instant, and of course, the moment he walks in the room, every eye goes to him. You can feel the presence of the man. Mm-hmm. And of course, Gita and Prashant surrender immediately, and he'll go on a tirade for something and give you some Dharma talk while he's doing it, and then elucidate some of the fine points. And of course, one of the greatest things about it being a master, he's not an armchair quarterback. He's an acharya. And that means not only he is like a PhD pundit in yoga philosophy, but he can show you in his body, not just say to somebody else more flexible, okay, you do the pose. No, no, no. He's able to show you right on his body. So it's remarkable that he can both theoretically tell you what to do, but practically show you how to do it. And then, depending on the body type in front of him, the student, the age, whatever, show you how to modify the pose to make it more improved and, of course, pain-free on the person who's the demonstration model. So that's a tour de force of teaching, which I guess there are other teachers who may do that in different fields as well, but certainly to be in the presence of a master who can do that, that's unforgettable. I would say, though, the biggest impact on me had to do with attending and eventually assisting in the medical classes. I have to admit that, as I believe my teacher was a rebel in his own way, even though he was a traditionalist in another way, I feel like I was a rebel in my way, even though I've tried to follow the tradition as well, in that I remember when this was before there was any certification in the teachers in the Iyengar tradition. The organization didn't develop till years later. But he would say, don't take on any therapeutic classes unless you've achieved a certain level of depth. And I never said it to him. I was always saying in my own mind, you're not talking to me, though. You're talking to other people who are going to be frightened off by what you're saying. And well, they should be, because they don't feel confident enough in themselves. But because I had the back injury, because I had been helped, I said, but you're not talking to me. So I have to admit, I never really listened to him that way. I just kept on studying, and it just didn't make any sense to me to try to send people from Chicago to somebody who was senior to me 150 miles away. I'm sorry. Out of compassion, you have to teach what you know to the people around you, even if that sometimes gets you in trouble with the hierarchy. But that's how it was. So I love that. And, you know, Gita Iyengar has a very different style. All three of them, the Iyengars, have very, very different styles. Mr. Iyengar is so knowledgeable that when he shares one thing going to one side, when you do it bilaterally to the other side, he has tons of other details. Just amazing. He's a fount of knowledge. Gita tends to be the kind of student teacher who hammers home the same point and repeats it again and again. and makes you go deeper. And by looking at it again, you get something, even though you thought that I heard you the third time. But by the seventh time, all of a sudden, you realize, okay, I get what she's saying. Just, you know, do it, and you're going to have a breakthrough. Prashant is probably the one who has the greatest English vocabulary range. Not that Mr. Iyengar or Geeta aren't fluent in English, even though Marathi and Hindi are more their basic natural languages. But Prashant seemed to have the widest vocabulary, and he was much more metaphoric in his use of insights than the Iyengar. But they're all brilliant in different ways, and you know, you get a chance to study with each of them during your course of study there. And of course, you want to also sit in on as many classes as you can, take as many notes as you can, even though they're just to watch them practice and learn tips about how they arrange themselves. So all of that was going on in India, as well as the fact that in Pune especially, there was the Osho Ashram, which for those who might remember who Bhagavan Sri Rajneesh was, which is another really interesting international scene of people coming and practicing yoga in a very, very different form. And they're also noted for having restaurants, not that you didn't want to eat Indian food, but they had restaurants that were more Western oriented. So, you know, people who were, for whatever reason, wanted variations on it, you could get your soy burgers and fresh squeezed carrot juice and just things that you wouldn't expect it would be on the Indian menu. So that was nice to have in Pune as well. So again, you can see a very, very positive experience. And then when I returned to Pune in the future, I learned again from having been there the first time, you don't have to stay at the local hotel and be safe. You can find a local family to stay with. And so there's a network to connect you to an Indian family. And that, again, is another in-depth experience to be living with people who, again, take you in so warmly and are so pro-yoga. That was another mind-boggling experience. And then once you do that a few times, then you're ready to say, okay, now I'm going to take my own apartment and I'm going to even find a way to hire somebody to give a job to somebody while I'm there for 6 weeks or whatever to come and cook for me and stuff like that and make it really easy on yourself. Another level of just uniting with the culture and supporting the local economy. So, well, you know, I'm just very fortunate. All those things worked for me. I traveled around India and went to live in a houseboat up in Kashmir, which was another incredible trekking and both a visual experience that was phenomenal and another embracing a broader part of India, because I like to say India is not just a country, it's a subcontinent. There's so much there. So again, you know, I'm fortunate to say I never got sick. I only had good experiences. I never got ripped off. And, you know, I can't deny that every country has things that people, you know, it goes wrong. They lose their luggage. They miss their flight. People are rude to them, whatever. But I can say, you know, fortunately, my experience in India has been really good karma. So, you know, I loved it.
Wonderful. So side note, I did my undergrad in Pune, and that city is something different altogether. It's called the Oxford of the East for knowledge, learning, and wisdom of all kinds. So I loved my experience when I was in Pune. Now, I was going through your Yoga U course page for the course called Yoga Mentoring Conscious Aging, and I stumbled upon a sentence that was really, really profound, which states that we do not have a choice about becoming older, but we do have a choice about becoming an elder. Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Sure. An elder is like taking a second birth. You know, most of the initiatory disciplines of the ancient world and the primal peoples had a rite of passage to enable a young boy or young girl to step up into their role as an adult. But a lot of times, we don't realize that you don't only go through one ritual initiation. One's whole life gives you opportunities for various ritual initiations. And especially in the United States that I grew up in, I was from a generation that we had a phrase, we didn't trust anybody over 30. We felt that in a certain way, the post-World War II generation and the early 60s had aspects of the way the government was conducting its business that was much more shadowy and not really in line with those of us who were educated by the post-World War II boom learned. And I think this was a shock to realize a lot of the older people in the United States don't have the finger on the pulse of what's really going on. It was almost like, you know, there was no older person to turn to because they all seemed to be co-opted by the system. So, but then as I realized, because I had one teacher who said to me, well, now you're almost 30 years old. What are you going to do? You're not going to trust anybody. You're 30 yourself. You better start learning about aging process and hanging out with people who are not just young. So that began a whole process in my life of getting involved in hospice and moving to Miami, where I could learn to work with an older population. Now, as a result of that, that started building in my mind different ideas about where is my own aging process leading. And of course, yoga has the idea of the guru, which represents a venerable person, a revered person, a sage-like person who's usually not young, somebody who's been doing this for many, many years. So their level of competence or their level of the trust that you can bring to somebody whose track record is so clear. But in the United States, we don't think about teachers and older people the same way that they project a almost divine infallibility upon the guru.
Yeah,
so
true.
I realize that there are different teachings. And again, I might be like rambling here a little bit to try to connect a number of the dots. But through the years, of course, I started studying fairy tales. And fairy tales turn out to be not only like bedtime stories for the nursery for the kids, but there are fairy tales for the middle years and then fairy tales for the older years, which I didn't realize at the time. And then I realized, obviously, they're trying to give people the same kind of clues that you might give a young initiate in the rite of passage from prepubescence and early adolescence to young man and womanhood. Now they're trying to tell you, well, there are other things you need to pay attention to once your kids have grown, or once you're so old that now you're facing your mortality. And that really perked me up. And then that was also connected to work in what I would call the men's field, men trying to become more conscious. I don't know if I would say that there's a men's movement that's similar to the way we define feminism, but in its own way, in the 80s, a whole new shift came about in terms of gender consciousness, which shifted me away from the spiritual idea of egolessness, which in a certain way made me transcend my whole sense of gender, to realizing maybe I'm missing something by not going deeper into my understanding of why did I incarnate as a man this time. And so by studying the teachings of the mature masculine, that also brought back to me the idea, well, who's going to give you a model of mature masculinity? Not a young boy, not even a young adult, but somebody who's been doing this for decades. And we can now we're entering the area of what I might call the sage or the wisdom figure or the healer, or so many words that represent the part of one's psyche where a certain kind of teaching transmission happens from somebody who's a past master and knows it, and then they're going to pass it on and fire up another person to get ready for what they have to face. So all those things kind of coalesce together with the idea that elders have always been around, wisdom people have always been around, but they're not people who always hang out their shingle. They're not like people out there trying to make a living out of this. They're people who have to be sought and people who have to be apprenticed to, which means in a certain way, you have to have the humility of realizing, I know something's missing in my life, I'm not sure what it is. And then you locate it in some person or some ideal or some power place. And then you have to go there to imbibe it and have it transmitted to you. And then you begin your apprenticeship in earnest, which means you're on that path, that left brain path, I said. But at the same time, you're realizing you're practicing the joy. You're not identified with the struggle of existence and your ego story. You're identified with the joy of being, because being involved in this path in some way is a tremendously positive and optimistic thing. So the elder, just something, as you get older, you realize that everyone's going to change in terms of their body losing certain capacities or limitations that happen as a result of, you know, your genetics, or, you know, they hire somebody younger than you who's faster than you and willing to do it for less money. All those things that might be problems of a person losing their grip just when you feel like you understand what's happening. Now you're kind of being phased out. But the elder is not about that. The elder is not about retiring. The elder is about recognizing the responsibility they have to pass on what they got when somebody paid it forward to them. And so you take an active interest in the lifestyle of younger men and women. And that's one of the things I learned from one of my mentors. First, if you're an elder, part of being an elder is to never let a day go by where you don't find a way to praise, compliment, recognize, confirm, appreciate, or what I would like to say, bless a younger man and a younger woman, so they can realize that you have seen them. You have seen that magnificent potential they have. You want them to get on fire with that and not be, think small. No one comes here to live a small life. And it has nothing to do with what the outside of your life looks like or whether or not you make a mark on history or become famous. Rumi has a poem that says, no outer work can be great if your inner work is small. And no outer work can be small if your inner work is great. So it doesn't matter what it looks like in the eyes of other people. You got to get on fire for doing your own work, and then sparks are going to fly, and something, you're going to give something back to people. So as an elder, You can do things to take an initiation to become more aware of the potency of your own aging process and how you can pass along your life wisdom, your tips, your guidance to people coming after you. And you take that as seriously as people take getting up and going to work every single day seriously. You got to work in the invisible as intensely as you work in the visible. And one of the ways that you know it, if you're an older person, and remember, you don't have to be 60 or 70 to start being an elder or a mentor for people who are a generation or two younger than you. You know, your guitar teacher is usually only 25 and you're 12. You know, it's not like you'd have to have a guitar teacher 75 teaching you. No. But the thing you got to ask yourself to understand if you need to get this coaching yourself is, when was the last time you looked at a younger man and a younger woman without envy, without jealousy, but saw how beautiful they were and said, you know, you got it, you know, whatever it was. I love the way you sing. I love the way you dress. I love the way you order your life or make your pasta sauce or whatever. Any kind of compliment to make them see they're seen. Somebody confirms their existence. In yoga, that's called darshan. You get the view of the guru. And just because the guru looks at you, it confers a sense of reality on you. The $200 psychological word is called the constituent glance of being. Somehow, because they saw you, you're more real. So that's it. You need somebody to punch your ticket and recognize you. And I ask people, when was the last time you did it? And if you can't even remember, that means you're probably suffering from hunger significance yourself. And you need someone to look at you, and what I call body and fender repair, and say, hey, you got it. And you need to get enough of that, like spiritual vitamins, in the form of the acknowledgement in order for you to go down and do likewise. So taking on eldering and mentoring younger generation has taken up a significant portion of my teaching and approach, both in and outside of the class. And again, the ultimate eldering is you also have to prepare yourself to face your own mortality. And so whether it's teaching people not only just your craft, but how you age, how you deal with illness, how you deal with losing people in one's life, ultimately, you know, dropping your own body. Those are all teachings that elders can give. But you don't do that just by snapping your fingers. You have to prepare yourself like you did in any other craft. So that's what I would say about eldering.
Well, thanks a lot for sharing those powerful stories, those powerful insights. Based on what we've learned today, if you had to advise one of your students to go out and take one action, just one action, to enhance the quality of their life, what would that one action be?
All right, so I'm going to give it like a final, like yogic shot across the bow to make the point. According to the yoga sutras, there's a definition of Kriya Yoga, which is called tapas, swadhyaya, and ishvara pranidhan. Tapas is the action-oriented part of the path. Swadhyaya is the study intellectually of the path. And ishvara pranidhan is the surrender to the heart space in the path. Basically, when you practice yoga, what you realize is you're doing the gym, the temple, and the university all at the same time. So what I would suggest for a new person is to be honest in terms of what is your natural leaning? What is your natural inclination? What is the way your gradient is? You know, just like a road is curved in a certain angle or direction of degree. Krishna says no one can deny their own nature. So what is your own nature? And if your own nature is an action-oriented person, then find any discipline that gets you moving, that gets you into your body, and take action that way. If you're a studious kind of person and, you know, reading or psychological, psychotherapy or discoursing is your cup of tea, then immerse yourself in the literature. There's tons of books out there by yoga masters and people in other fields that are psychologically astute. Many men and women have left very, very articulate expositions of the path. And of course, poetry is a fantastic way, if you're into the head, to learn how to penetrate language and see the symbols in it. And then, of course, if you're a heart-oriented person, well, not everybody will find their way to a guru or a figure who they feel they can love. But I would start off by saying, look at the relationships that are in your life. And you realize that you have people in your life who you care about tremendously. Either their being in their presence turns you on, or they're funny, or they're supportive, or they're wise, or out of compassion. Maybe they're suffering in a certain way and your heart goes out to them. Follow your heart leanings to be vulnerable about your own emotions, and don't try to make it sound like you're further along or better off than you really are, when you know that behind the scene there's something you haven't addressed, because that's where, you know, all these inquiries are going to take you. Are you willing to face what you've been avoiding all this time? And that takes you into your emotions. And of course, you can only heal what you can feel. So if you're that kind of person, then go into the devotional practices. And then, of course, as yoga says, spend time in stillness and silence. And so I guess I would add a fourth one. If you're a contemplative type, then I would say find a way to just be quiet. And there are many, many meditation techniques that teach you how to quiet your mind and sit still. And of course, all of those together become the way that your life path turns out. Everybody is going to act in some way. Everybody's going to think in some way. Everybody's feeling in some way. And everybody wonders. Everybody looks up at the heavens and just wonders, what is this whole thing about? So ultimately, of course, you're supposed to have a balance of all four of those paths. So it really doesn't matter which one you choose. Like they say, once you're on the highway towards the capital, every step you take is taking you in the right direction. So whether you choose the path of the body, the mind, the heart, or the contemplative path, they're all going to lead you to yoga.
Action Tribe, to access the show notes for today's episode, visit my7chakras.com/139. That's my7chakras.com/139. In the confrontation between stream and the rock, the stream always wins, not through strength, but by perseverance. This is a quote by Jackson Brown. Action Tribe, the message is loud and clear here. You are a stream that begins as a trickle high up in the mountains, and your goal in life is to join the ocean. And on this way, you will come across many challenges of all shapes and sizes, like rocks or stones or pebbles and boulders. And sometimes it might feel like you will never get past those rocks and become one with the others in the ocean. Whenever you feel that way, remember that there is power in flexibility. There is power in intention, and as Mr. Brown reminded us, there is power in perseverance. So Gabriel, talk to us about a major challenge that you experienced in your life. Firstly, how did you encounter it? And then, for the benefit of our listeners, how did you overcome the obstacle?
I'm experiencing the major challenge right now in my life, so I can't talk about overcoming the obstacle. Mm-hmm. I can only tell you about how my path got me here. About 2 years ago, in May, I had to have a prostate operation. And then about a month after that, I got hit with an inflammatory disease that basically crippled me and turned me from an old man into what seemed like to be an elderly man. It was really shocking for the Iron Man in me to go down for the first time in 4.5 decades. So the last 2 years have been this ongoing recovery through the use of medication, supplements, and I didn't really have to change my lifestyle, continue to do the things that I was always doing before in terms of diet and media and who I hang out with and what I do to recover as much as I possibly can a lot of movements that have been lost because of the inflammation. So in a certain way, and this has been a thing I've been role modeling to my whole community as the elder of my community, how I handle with as much grace as possible, how I can bear my own suffering with as much dignity as possible without giving up, without stopping my practice, however much I've had to modify. And remember one of the life lessons from my teacher, which is within my limitation, I'm unlimited. So I've been embodying that. So I can't say that I've conquered it by any means, but I'm certainly working with it and have so many people wishing healing thoughts to me. And that keeps me going because I know people care about me and want me to be well. I don't see that as a pressure on me to have to get well, but as good wishes and intentions. So I'm working through that right now.
So based on your story, first of all, thanks a lot for sharing your challenge, your story with us today. What is that one major life lesson that you'd like to share with our listeners today?
Have fun. Don't waste another day in telling anybody who you care about that you love them. Call them on the phone, text them, send them an email, you know, write them a snail mail. But there's no sense in holding back. Most of the time, you'll realize that if you would have said it, you would have felt better. If you would have done it, you would have felt better. So why inhibit yourself? You know, there's only one you. No one can be the way you are. And so in a very positive way, strut your stuff and tell the people that you care about that you love them.
So again, thanks a lot for sharing your story, your challenge with us. Just so that this message sinks deep into our minds, I'm going to restate the sequence that you just shared with us. You shared that about 2 years back, you had and still have a health challenge that sort of changed you from the Iron Man that you felt you were to an elderly man comparatively because of the medications or the change in lifestyle. You mentioned a lot of movement was lost due to the medication, which I'm sure is a challenge for the yogi master that you are and your practice and your lifestyle that you've enjoyed over the years. But you taught us one thing today. Within our limitation, we are unlimited. And that is so powerful. And yet you've taken time today as well to chat with us and share this beautiful message that resonates very clearly in our listeners' mind, that having fun is important because living here and now is critical. So don't hold back, as you mentioned, but just take action. Action Tribe, make that call, write that letter, hug that one person who you've been thinking about and has been prolonged till now, but just do it. So thanks a lot for your message, Gabriel.
All right. Now, I'd like to tell people how they might get in touch with me if they want to like follow up on this. My website is yogacircle.com. There you can find out. We're hot linked to a lot of other nice sites. There's a pull down window for me where you can hear some of my Dharma talks for free. And there's a connection to another website there where you can purchase some MP3 downloads if you want to. And just wonderful information that if people want to find a way to continue their yoga practice or contact me personally, that would be the best way to do it. YogaCircle.com.
Wonderful. We'll have this in the show notes as well. Gabriel, at this point, what is your life's calling?
Well, first and foremost, it's to be a good husband and a good father and take all the things I've learned from yoga and my life experience and embody them. It's certainly easier when you're on the teaching stage to have people throw accolades on you and, you know, like to say, it's good to be king, you know. But but when I come home, as my wife says, the garbage needs to go out, oh, master of awareness. You know, the grounding and reality of trying to keep my relationship going. You know, we've been together 25 years. We're eye to eye looking at each other, say, till death do us part. So the first thing I would say is I want to see my relationship through till the end of my life. And I want to be there for as long as I can for my girls to provide for them, you know, the next level. You know, even as they watch me age, it's an initiation to something. They're learning something about, I like to think, courage and how to maintain your own personal integrity when you're challenged. So those are probably primary things for me. And then when my younger daughter gets out of college next year, they're already empty nesters, but reinvent the relationship. What's the next goal? Now that we've gotten the girls through college, what's the next goal? So I would say, I don't know if that's why I came here. You know, if you got another minute, this is one of the interesting things. I don't know whether or not I've already passed on, you know, not all the information, but have I already inspired one person to take what it is they feel they got from me and go pay it forward? I know there are many, many people who've been influenced by me, but do I really know who is that one person? No. So in a certain way, I still keep that fire going because I never know who the person is who maybe this is the person who I'm supposed to meet. So that keeps me on my edge. It just, you know, it reminds me of something I heard from the author of Eat, Pray, Love, that when she first went to some affair that was like honoring her, somebody came up to her after she just won like an Emmy or an award for, you know, the adaptation of the film or something like that and said, so now what are you going to do? And it struck her like, oh my God, now what am I going to do? Does that mean like I've already given my best shot? But I'm a writer. What am I going to do for these next 50 years of my life?
Yeah.
So that's what I thought. I don't know. I don't know if I've passed on the information. So every person I meet, I'm looking to see, is this a person who I now connect and I don't know how far it's going to go? So that's kind of exciting that, you know, like I said, I'm not sure what my life purpose is other than to be a good human being and share what I've shared with people till the day I die.
That's really powerful. Now, if you had to relive the memories of your life, is there a defining moment that really changed things for you?
I can't reduce it to one. It's like asking me, what's your favorite Beatles song? I can't reduce it to one. But if I had to say one thing, learning to play the guitar, bring music into my life, sing, write my own songs, I would say in some way that was a major shift in my whole life when I was 12 years old.
Thanks a lot for sharing. And with that, we have arrived at the very last round for today, the wisdom round. And our listeners know that the purpose of this rapid fire round is to take notes and take action. So are you ready?
Let's do it.
What is the best advice that someone's ever given you?
I can't say that it's a stumper, but again, you know, there's a lot of different pieces of advice. Question authority and think for yourself.
So name a personal habit that keeps you going.
Getting up and doing pranayama at 5:30 in the morning.
So what does your morning routine look like? Or do you have a morning routine in the first place?
I do. I wake up about 5:30 and I'll sit in meditation and I usually will count 30 breaths to see if my mind is concentrated. And if I lose count, I go back and start at one again. Once I've got my mind concentrated to that extent, sometimes I get scattered enough where like the whole time is spent just going back to one and starting up to see if I can do 30 in a row. But most days, of course, I do. So once I get there, then I do various breath practices, usually based on either what I have to teach that day so I can be fresh, or based on what I feel my own body needs in terms of calming myself or energy. If I realize it's a full day and I need to stimulate myself, that'll be a breath practice. And then after that, which could take anywhere from 30 to 45 minutes, I'll usually lie down in Shavasana and just regenerate. Do, I would say, my own version of prayers and sending well wishes, metta, loving kindness to different people who are in my prayer circle who I feel need healing and who I want to connect with, I guess we would say, astrally or like on a subtle level. And then I'll get up and drink a big glass of water. And depending on what I have on my plate in terms of when do I have to get out of my house, I would, you know, take more or less time in getting ready in terms of, you know, a shower daily and shave daily and eat lightly and then move on. And then usually, you know, in terms of routine, not in the morning, but like, you know, I save my asana practice. My own body biorhythm feels the best in the mid to late afternoon. So I usually don't do a heavier asana practice till 4 to 5 in the afternoon. And then again, depending on how much time I have available, it could be an hour to an hour and a half. So basically, that would be my routine.
Thanks a lot for sharing. Name a book that you'd like to recommend for our listeners today.
Again, one book is really hard. The Perennial Philosophy, Aldous Huxley.
So Action Tribe, to access today's show notes, visit my7chakras.com/139. That's my7chakras.com/139. So Gabriel, thank you so much for joining us today. There were so many things that you taught us in this short span of time, so many ways of looking at life and reevaluating what is the narrative or the story that's going on in our life. You spoke about the importance of humility, importance of not just growing old, but becoming elderly, the importance of loving, not regretting, and of taking action and really following our dream and being in the here and now. Those beautiful paradoxes that you created for us that really allow us to live life to the fullest. Before you go, tell us one thing that you are really grateful for and tell us the best way we can find you online. You shared your website, so I have that. That's yogacircle.com. But for now, tell us one thing that you are grateful for.
all the people in my life. My own family, even though I've gone on a very radically different path than them, the fact I just incarnated in a family that I went through yoga and was something very, very different from them, that was a great learning experience for me. My wife and girls, of course, have probably been the most grounding and joy-producing aspect of my life, so more good people in my life. And, of course, my yoga community that I've been so blessed to be involved in my own studio for over 30 years, and I've been so warmly welcomed across the country in many, many yoga studios. Again, all people who have opened their hearts and minds to me. So I could never say one person, but just I'm just thrilled that the way I'm going to choose to spin it is that spirit is working my life that way. And I brought all these people to bless me. And I certainly hope that I've been able to like give them something they feel is worthy as well.
That's amazing. So Gabriel, thank you so much for coming on our show, reminding us about the magic of yoga, yoga asana, yoga philosophy, yoga lifestyle, and taking us one step closer to a human revolution.
Sounds great. I'm in there. If there's something else you know that I can do, you don't hesitate to call me.
You are listening to My Seven Chakras. Go to mysevenchakras.com. Download your free gift, get inspired, and take action. Transform your life today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.